I've been telling about the William Child family and then how William taught us young folks down Blue Water how to play musical instruments. Along with the other things, Clifford learned to play a trombone. But when we went to Grant to go to high school, we found that we knew how to play musical instruments, whereas most of the kids that went to Grant Junior High didn't know, so we had a small advantage there. But I never did really know why William didn't continue on as the architect of the band that he had started there at Blue Water. I've oftentimes regretted that I really didn't help the Child family better than I did. Marion Child was just younger than I was, and Doris Ida was quite a bit younger. I guess she was 3 years younger than I was, maybe four. And that I could have been a lot nicer to those kids than what I was. I don't really know whether I purposely avoided them or whether I just didn't realize what was going on, how poor they were, or anything, but there was a lot of times that I could have helped them that I didn't make any effort to help them. And yet when I met Marion in Salt Lake City about a year ago, well, it's only been 6 months ago that I met her up there, I was surprised to find that she couldn't remember any of the ill feelings that she might have harbored about her childhood in Blue Water, but she had apparently forgiven all of these things and had a very good spirit, a forgiving attitude if she could remember anything. I can't believe it. She feels so friendly towards us after everything that we in Blue Water did to the Child family.
Were they? Or that on payroll robbery and that type of thing?
Water in Blue Water has always been a life or death affair. If we had plenty of water, well, there was plenty of crops. If there was a shortage of water, well, then we had a shortage of crops. So water was always considered a very valuable item. The old timers built a couple of dams only to have them washed out from time to time. But anyway, in the beginning, in the early days of the valley, the bishop was also not only the bishop, but he was the water master. And as days went along, they decided that they had a water district. They had to borrow money to build a dam. And so they established the water district according to the laws of the state of New Mexico, which stated that they had to vote and have a water master. So Grandpa Titchen was the bishop for many years, and he was also the water master. And J. Fred Nielsen wanted to be the water master, but he was never the bishop, and so it was his desire that he'd be bishop someday so that he could be the water master also. And at about the time that Brother J. Fred got to be bishop, they established the Blue Water Irrigation District, and so they voted as to who the district wanted for water master, and Tom McNeil was voted in as water master. Well, Brother Fred figured that the bishop had always been the water master, and therefore he figured that the bishop should continue being the water master. And he and Tom McNeil used to get up on the ditch bank and argue about it. Very often they argued about it. Fred said he was bishop, and therefore he was the one that had the authority to say who got the water and who didn't get the water. And Tom McNeil said he had been elected water master, and so he was the one that had the authority to turn the water on or off. One morning, well, Brother Fred went up to the irrigation ditch, turned the water down on his farm. Brother Tom McNeil happened along about that time and wanted to know who had given Fred the authority to turn the water on. Fred said he was bishop and he could take the water anytime he wanted to take it. Tom counteracted, saying that he was the water master and Fred couldn't have the water. And they stood on the ditch bank there and argued for a little while, and finally Tom McNeil, who was about twice as big as Fred Nielsen, picked J. Fred up and threw him in the ditch and said, all right, you can have the whole dang thing then if you want the water that bad. Well, Brother Fred was hard of seeing and had a very special pair of glasses that he wore so that he could see. And when Tom McNeil picked him up and threw him in the ditch, well, the glasses fell off. And so Fred waded around in the mud a little bit. At that particular place, the ditch is about 6 feet deep. Us kids always went swimming there when I came along. This little episode happened way back in the, well, about 18 and 95 or somewhere in that area. But anyway, Fred waded around a little bit, couldn't find his glass, so Tom took his boots off and he climbed in the ditch after Fred. And they both looked and they couldn't find it, the glasses, and Fred couldn't see a blooming thing without his glasses on, so it was essential that they find the glasses. So finally, Tom McNeil ran up and down the ditch and opened all the head gates and let all the water out of the ditch. They drained it so that that Fred McNielsen could find his glasses where they'd fell off. In the early days of the church, or Blue Water and Rhema, Grandpa Kitchen was instructed to make friends of the Indians. So he lived among the Indians quite a bit. Of course, the marshals coming in and looking for polygamists were always around trying to find out who was polygamist and who wasn't. And the Indians got in the habit of considering the Mormons as their best friends, these marshals and others as their enemies. And quite often, some of the marshals or one of the white people would turn up missing, the Indians having killed them or somebody else having killed them. And so the government sent in men to find out just why or what had been happening to their officers that they sent in that part of the country. And they'd go around asking the Indians, who told you to kill so-and-so, or who told you to do this and that? The Indians didn't understand English any more than the white people understand it Navajo or Zunis. About the only thing they knew was they were hungry, and they'd say pa, which meant bread in one of their languages, that they wanted bread, and they'd hold their hand out and say pa. It's not quite pa, but anyway, basically that's it. And so the officials decided that they were saying that Pa Titchin was the one that was getting the Indians to waylay these government officials. And so Grandpa Titchin had quite a time. He had to avoid all strangers for fear that one of them might come after him and shoot him, because they thought that Grandpa Titchin was the ringleader of all the Indians around that area and for the troubles that the Indians caused some of the white people. But Grandpa Titchin had a fairly large family, inasmuch he had three wives. Basically, the family got along very well with him, but he had one boy, Almy Titchin, that was a mischievous little boy. About everything that I ever heard about Almy and Grandpa Titchin was about the tricks that Almy pulled on Grandpa Titchin. One time, well, go back a little ways, Grandpa Titchin, having came from the old country, a part of Germany that had currant juice in order to preserve foods for their, so they could keep their food over winter time. Well, the currants were turned into a wine, so they had a currant juice wine. And Grandma Titchen, being raised in Norway like she was, in Denmark, she also was acquainted with this currant juice wine that they used. This is one of the ways that they were able to live over the cold winter months, was by having different foods of this type. They brought that habit to this country. They had currant juice wine here. And Grandpa Titchen was bishop at the time this particular incident took place. It was also a custom at that time, if anybody did anything that was considered wrong, that they would get up in front of the church members and confess that they had did something wrong and ask for forgiveness.
No.
The bishop had it in his power that he could call anybody out of the audience and say, well, now, so-and-so, you did certain thing, and you must get up and ask for the community's apologies and forgiveness. And it was generally accepted that this was the way that things should be operated. Well, anyway, Almy Titchen got a hold of some whiskey one day, or alcohol, and he poured it in Grandpa Titchen's currant wine. And Grandpa got up Sunday morning, and as his custom was, he had 2 cups of this currant wine. He figured that was good for his health. Inasmuch as it was homemade, they didn't consider that such a bad thing. But anyway, Almy had spiked this wine with alcohol. Well, no, it wasn't strong enough to make a person really drunk. You could have got drunk on it, but you'd have to drink a tremendous amount. And I suppose 2 cups of it each day would have given a person quite a few vitamins, especially when they were short of food like they were oft times in Raymond Blue Water near the dirt. But by the time Grandpa Titchen had left for the church house, well, he was beginning to feel real good. In fact, a little bit too good. And when he got to church, well, he got up on the behind the pulpit, brought the meeting to open the meeting, and then he started calling people out of the audience, having them confess and ask forgiveness for this and for that. And he was really having a big time. He had called about half of the community up to ask for forgiveness for something and another.
Did he stipulate what that was?
I got it turned off.
Did he actually ask them to beg forgiveness for certain things, or just whatever they felt like?
No, as a general rule, he stated right out and out what they were to ask forgiveness for, or something in that nature. About that time, the 2 counselors to Grandpa Titchen decided that something was immensely wrong, because never before had they seen Grandpa Titchen ask so many people to get up and ask for forgiveness. So then they kind of investigated, smelt Grandpa Titchen, and they decided he was just about drunk. They could smell the alcohol on his breath and everything like that. So they brought the meeting to a close, and they took Grandpa Titchen home and put him to bed. The next week, they had Almy Titchen up, asking forgiveness for what he had done to Grandpa Titchen the week before. Almy Titchen worried Grandpa Titchen an awful lot. And it's said that he worried so much about Almy that he even dreamed about him. And one time, Grandpa Titchen called Almy over and he said, Alma, I'm worried about you. He said, I dreamed that you died. You started up to go to heaven, and old St. Peter standing at the gates met you, and they said, no, Almy, you can't come in here. Said, we haven't got a place for a person of your type. So Grandpa says, Almy, won't you please try to straighten up and do something a little better so that this dream won't come true. Now, Almy thought about it and thought about it. Finally said, well, Dad, you know, he said, I had a dream about you too. He said, I dreamed that I died. Just like in your dream, I went to heaven and old St. Peter wouldn't let me pass the pearly gates. So he said, I figured the only place I go is to hell. And so he said, I went down below and there was a great big old hall with a lot of people or men sitting in it. And he said, I looked around and there was only one vacant chair in the whole room, a great big room with only one vacant chair. And he said, well, he guessed that chair was for him. So he marched over there and says, I sat down in that chair. And he said, no more, and sat down in the chair. And the devil let out a roar and jumped out from his chair and run down there and grabbed me and throwed me out. And he said, that chair is reserved for old man Titchin. Get the hell out of here. And he said, Dad, he said, if I can't go to heaven and the devil kicks me out of hell, well, where in the hell am I going to go? So that was the end of that little episode. Well, when Grandpa Titchin decided to settle Blue Water, basically the land was open and anybody could run their cattle on it that wanted to run it. And there was a large cattle company, I think they called themselves the Bar S Ranch. They had their headquarters up about where the railroad depot was many years back, maybe a half a mile west of where the railroad depot was. We call it the old white, big white house. And that was the ranch headquarters. It was the custom to take the cattle and just turn them loose and let them run all winter, and then the next spring they'd have a gentle roundup. They'd just send cowboys all over the country and round up the cattle, and if they found any strays, they'd brand them with their brand, or they'd... But anyway, it was an open range. When Grandpa Titchin came into the country, he and Fred Nielsen and T.J. McNeil, Brother Chapman, well, they built fences around their property. Of course, this didn't please this big ranch that there was fences being put up. So they determined that Grandpa Titchin was the ringleader of it. And they used to bring men in to kill Grandpa. Gunslingers or professional killers were brought in to kill Grandpa Titchin, and they thought that if they get rid of Grandpa Titchin, they get rid of the rest of the Mormons that was putting the fences around his property. One of the gunslingers that was brought into the valley to get rid of Grandpa Titchin, unknown to each other, they became well acquainted with each other and learned to respect each other to a certain extent. It was then that the gunslinger learned that the man that he was to kill was one of the people that he had learned to respect in that part of the neighborhood. So he refused to carry out his end of the contract and was finally fired by the ranch. He disappeared from the country. Another gunslinger that was brought in was, he knew who Grandpa Titchin was and was waiting to catch him alone or and get him into a fight so that they could each draw a gun and he could have a legal reason to shoot Grandpa Titchin. And Grandpa Titchin by this time had learned that they were after him, and because the first gunslinger that he had became friends with had told him that that was the reason he was brought to this country, was kill him, to kill Grandpa Titchin. So Grandpa Titchin made certain that if he was anywhere in that area that he had somebody with him as a witness. So this gunslinger kept hanging around the White House and waiting for the time that he could kill Grandpa Titchin. Right at the White House theirself, they didn't have any water, so they had to cross the Roya and go a little ways off on the other side where they had some drinking water. Twice a day, this gunslinger got up, went across the Roya. There was a log that had came down. A big flood had brought the log down and washed it in such a fashion that it had lodged from one bank to the other, and it made almost a perfect footbridge. And this is what the gunslinger used to cross the Roya and go get fresh water twice a day. There was always a little bit of water ponded in the Roya just below this bridge. And one day as the gunslinger was walking across the bridge, he fell off into this puddle of water that was below it. Whether he hit his head on a rock or on the log or what, I don't know. But anyway, he drowned in a little puddle of water, not very deep. And that very same day, it rained a little bit. The flood came along and they washed his body a little ways down the creek. And about a week later, they had a tremendous storm that sent a big flood down, and it picked up this same log and washed it on down the creek so that the people of Blue Water never did see it. It had been said that one of the Mormon men had came along soon after he had fell in the water and that he was still breathing when this man passed. But the man went on because he said the old boy was better off dead than he was alive, raised in hell with the Mormons. So he let him die because he didn't want him around anymore. So that was what happened to the second gunslinger that was sent to the country after Grandpa Titchin. About the time that Grandpa Titchin moved into Rayma, New Mexico, it was soon after the Civil War had ended. And the Confederate soldiers, some of the Union soldiers, having lost most of their family and being poor, went into Texas. And in order to get substance to live on, they committed quite a few crimes. So they became known as outlaws. Texas didn't want them any more than any other state did. And it was rumored in Texas that Robber's Roost in Utah was the best place for a displaced person like these Confederate soldiers. The best place they could find to live was up in the Robber's Roost up in Utah. There were so many hiding places that the deputy sheriffs or nobody else had any luck in finding them. So there started to begin a migration of Texas outlaws from Texas up through New Mexico into Utah and this panhandle, or the Robber's Roost area. And one of the routes they took was by the Inscription Rock and over by Rayma, New Mexico, and then on up to Pass Gallup and into Moab in that area. Of course, the outlaws, time they got to Rayma, their horses were usually sick and tired or foot sore, and so they needed new horses, or sometimes they got there without any horses at all. This one particular group of robbers, but the people of Rayma discovered that if they watched things quite closely, that the outlaws didn't bother them too much. And so the Rayma people, the men would go out the furthest, and they'd herd the livestock, cows and sheep like this, and the boys would be a little closer to town, they'd have some more animals. On this particular day, they kept the horses in a corral. I don't know why they had them in a corral, or at least penned up so they could be gotten easily. And the robbers came down the valley and they
kind of scouted around. There was a group of them. They discovered that there wasn't any men in the community, that it was all women and children. So they went down, kind of herded the women and children together in one general area, and told them not to make any fuss or to keep, and to keep still. They then took all of the horses that the Rama people had and headed out over the mountain. Now there's one young boy that had a little more nerve than the rest of the kids, and as soon as he saw the chance, he took off and run up the hill and told Grandpa Titchen, who was hoeing weeds about a half mile from town, that the robbers or the outlaws had came and swiped all their horses. Well, Grandpa Titchen had an old mule that he was riding at the time that But anyway, after Grandpa Titchen had been informed about the actions of the outlaws, he jumped on the mule and went downtown and picked up the outlaws' tracks and started following them across the hills. Meanwhile, the young lad had went on to tell the rest of the men that was further away from the village what had taken place. Grandpa Titchen had left instructions for them to follow as fast as they could. Some of them had horses and some were on foot. But anyway, Grandpa Titchen tracked the outlaws for quite a distance, and he finally found them at Stinking Springs about 8 o'clock at night. It was after dark. He found where they had camped at Stinking Springs, close to Pruitt, New Mexico. And he determined he was going to sneak in and open the pens. There was a kind of a kraal built back up into the one of the sandstone coves there. They had logs across the mouth of it so they could lock the logs, and the horses or cattle, whatever it might be, in the kraal couldn't get out. So Grandpa determined he was going to climb in there and let the logs down and stampede the horses and get his horses back. One of the horses was Grandpa Titchen's pet horse, and he kind of smelled or knew Grandpa was in the neighborhood, so he'd winter. And the outlaws decided something was funny, so they sent some men out to act as spies, and they found Grandpa Titchen and captured him. After they'd captured Grandpa Titchen, they didn't know what to do, because if they shot him, then the other settlers in the valley would find the Grandpa Titchen's body there with bullet holes in it, and they'd know who had done it. They wanted it to look like it was an accident, so it was decided that they would take Grandpa Titchen and stake him down in front of the gate that the animals there, the horses that they had in that kraal at Stinking Springs, so the horses, when they run out, they'd run over top of Grandpa Titchen, and his death would look like it was an accident. When Grandpa Titchen's old pet horse whinnied, the robbers decided that something was wrong out there, and so they sent watchmen out to see what was going on, and the next thing Grandpa Titchen knew, one of their watchmen had found him trying to sneak into the camp to undo the bars to the gate. Now that they had Grandpa Titchen, the outlaws didn't know what to do, because if they shot Grandpa Titchen, then everybody in the territory would come to seek and find out who had shot Grandpa Titchen and what they were doing. They'd pretty well string him up. On the other hand, they couldn't let Grandpa Titchen loose, so they decided that if they could make the accident, the death of Grandpa Titchen look like it was an accident, that nobody'd bother him. So they took him and staked him down right in line with the fence, or the gate, to this little kraal. And they decided that the horses would go across Granville Ditchin and they'd be stepped on and he'd be killed. It looked like an accident. But they didn't want to do it until daylight. They didn't know quite where he's at, and they was afraid to travel at night in that area, and so they decided to wait until daylight to run the horses over Granville Ditchin. So they left him staked out.